From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show. Really proud today to be joined by Kelly Brothers. And if you don't know Kelly, he is a celebrity here in town, and he's really a financial mind in the Sacramento region and beyond. So we're going to share his story a little bit, get some advice, some wisdom from him. But just to remind you what our show is all about, it's all about winning. It's all around building the backyard advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And it's based around this culture of love, right? Showing love to one another, helping one another. And we do enough of that, we actually have an advantage right here in the hometown we love. So Kelly being on the show, I think this is great because you're a hometown guy as well. You've lived here all your life. Let's get to know you a little bit. Who is Kelly Brothers?
That's a great question, Mark. I'm still figuring it out, to be honest with you, but you're right. Number one is to know, you know, I'm the product of immigrants. My folks were off the boat from Ireland, and they got very fortunate, and that in and of itself is a great story of how they came here. It kind of informs some of the ongoing angst about immigration today, I think, in many regards.
Did they come and go like through Ellis Island or something like that?
Yeah. So my dad grew up, they both grew up in very poor surroundings in Ireland. My mom on a farm. My dad was in a little town. His mother died when he was 9. He was orphaned out to family, then brought back, then dad brought them all back together again. But it was, he was in a place where his opportunities were limited. Let's just put it that way. So he had a cousin by the name of Joe Ryan, and Joe was a farmer in Rio Vista, California. And I remember going down and visiting Joe as a little tyke because he had tractors, and you, a little kid never forgets a man with tractors, right? But Joe went over to visit Ireland, and my dad kind of showed him around and took him out to dinner and for a pint of Guinness or something, you know. And at the end of 2 or 3 days there, Joe said to my dad, "Hey, Pete, you know, I don't know if you ever thought of this, but if you ever had any interest in emigrating to the United States, I would sign on as your sponsor." And to a young man in Ireland in that day and age, this is the mid-50s, that was like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. You know, that was, you had to have a sponsor. You couldn't emigrate otherwise. And a sponsor was a big deal because Joe was going to sign a piece of paper saying, if this guy doesn't pay a bill, I'm on the hook.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Think about that. You're taking on, you know, you're taking on that responsibility. You're signing personally on someone else's debts who you don't really know. Okay. Mm-hmm. So so Joe was a very generous man to do so. My dad thought, oh man, this opportunity may never pass again. I'm in. So he took Joe up on his offer, and he put in his notice on his job, and he started selling everything he has, because in those days you left, you didn't come back.
Right.
But there was one thing bugging my dad, and that is he had a pain in his side for about 2 years, and the doctor had called it chronic appendicitis. Never heard of that before or after, but that's what the doctor told my dad it was. And my dad had this, he was thinking, he was like, oh man, my appendix burst in Ireland, nationalized medicine. My appendix burst in America, I'm insolvent. And Joe Ryan gets a bill, you know, because he didn't have medical care. He didn't have insurance, right? So my dad faked an attack of appendicitis with the
In Ireland
with the express intent of getting his appendix out before he left so that it could cause him no problems when he got here. So he went in, he faked an attack. He's like, oh, doc, the pain in my side, doc, it's killing me. And so the doctor's like, well, Mr. Brothers, you've had chronic appendicitis. Maybe we should just take your appendix out. You think so, doc? You think we should? Okay, go ahead and take it out. They took out his appendix. Doctor was quoted as saying, this is the smallest appendix I've ever seen. There's nothing wrong with this appendix. They took it out. But that was my dad. He was not going to, he was going to, you know, that was risk management to my dad, right? He just didn't want the fear of, man, if this thing goes. So the good news for me and my siblings and my kids and everything is that the nurse in the recovery room would become our mother.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Because she had, they had never met before. They met and she was on her way. She had accepted a 6-month job at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. And so my dad was able to say to her, well, if you ever wanted to come to California, now you'll have a friend in California. Wow. And she came and they never left.
That's incredible. I mean, great story, but also thinking about your dad and the type of person that he was, in that he wouldn't want somebody else to care for him like that or have to, you know, pay his debts in the event that he couldn't do it. To have him take on that full-blown operation prior to coming out, just in case. That shows, I mean, so the type of guy, that's the type of guy that raised you.
Oh, God, I was so lucky, Mark, you know, just to have two parents who were, I mean, they instilled discipline. There's no doubt about it. But their only goal, and we only learned this later, was that we get educated to the highest possible level that we could. Coming from two people who that had not been an option. My mom went through nursing school, but my dad didn't have any college at all. Although, so my dad comes to America, and on his resume, he had a few interviews that Joe helped him set up in Sacramento. He had gone to Christian Brothers College in Ireland. That was the name of his high school, Christian Brothers College. Oh. And he was smart enough, he put it on there. He didn't say anything about it, but he didn't explain it either. And so at his retirement dinner, the man who hired him was there. And when I told him he never spent a day in college, he's like, oh. What do you mean he never spent a day in college?
That's hilarious. So he worked at the same place for a long time, it sounds like.
Well, he worked for, that's another part. So he went to work for CalWest Life Insurance, which was at 21st and L Streets. The building is still there. We used to think it was a skyscraper. I think it's 6 stories high. But when he came over, he took a job there. He took a job at that Safeway on Alhambra. He took a job at a gas station. And he just, because he wanted to build up enough money that Joe Ryan would never get a bill. Mm-hmm. And so he worked that for a while. But we were so lucky, Mark, you know, to think back on, and I'll tell you kind of the seminal story of money management, financial management, understanding it, what drove me into financial planning. So 1988, my parents had 4 kids in Catholic universities, 4 of them. Whoa. So Notre Dame, Santa Clara, St. Mary's, Loyola Marymount. And it was the only year they had all 4 in college at one time.
Wow.
And
money.
My dad lost his job. Cal West was bought by another company and they let him go. You know, separate story, but 6-9 months later, he was offered his job back because they should not have let go. Mm-hmm. They should not have let him go. But anyway, they let him go. And I was the eldest. And I remember calling my dad saying, hey, Dad, I can finish up next year. No problem. Why don't I come home? And I just want to make sure that, you know, the other kids weren't disrupted. I'm almost done. Mm-hmm. Right. And he said, are you crazy? He said, your mom and I have been planning for this for 25 years. Study hard, have fun. I'll see you at graduation and don't mention this again. And so that was when the light bulb went on that, wow, that's why, you know, our vacations weren't big fancy vacations. We were camping at Lake Tahoe, or that's why we drove 10 and 12 year old cars. And that's why, because that wasn't part of the plan. Part of the plan was the schools we were going to, you know? And so very fortunate to figure that out and be grateful for that. And, you know, within, not only did my dad end up doing fine, but within 3 years they had cajoled each of us into getting master's degrees, because that was their goal. We're coming to America and our kids are going to have opportunities we never had. And we all did.
Yeah. You went to Notre Dame, right?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you went along, you all went on to get your master's degree.
I have a brother who got a law degree, and then me and my two sisters and I, we all got masters. Yeah.
Wow. We talked the other day. This is kind of interesting timing. You have a podcast called, what's the name of it again? I'm sorry.
Bite-Size Finance.
Bite-Size Finance. How do I forget that? So I want to get into your, what you do now, but in order, we talked about, somehow you got this out of me that I had a newspaper route, and you had a newspaper route as a little kid too. We talked about that a little bit. So, and now you have this entrepreneurial thing going as well. You know, you've built a successful wealth management business, and I know it's transitioned somewhat. We'll get into that, but have you always felt like you were kind of entrepreneurial?
I always wished I was entrepreneurial.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. And in order to try different things, sometimes I needed the support of a great wife, mm-hmm. or my parents. You need someone kind of saying, hell yeah, you could do that. So, I came out of MBA school, my goal was I had worked a year between undergrad and grad school, and I'd when I graduated from college, my friends were going off to their big jobs in New York and Chicago or on to med school or whatever, and I packed up the Buick and I hugged my mom and dad and I said goodbye to my friends and I hit Interstate 80 I took a job in beautiful North Platte, Nebraska. So I was, I graduated on a Sunday. Wednesday night, I anchored the evening news in North Platte, Nebraska.
Okay, so that was your first job as anchor. So, okay, that's interesting. You said beautiful North Platte. Were you being facetious or was it a beautiful place?
Well, it's a nice place. I would never, it's not beautiful, but okay. It's a nice, but at the time, it was the smallest city in the country with an NBC affiliate.
Okay.
There's 35,000 people there. But they had a TV station. And so, but the cool part was, man, I did everything. When the weather guy was sick, I did weather. When the sports guy was sick, I did sports. I did a Saturday morning kid show. I did everything. And I was there for a year and it was fantastic. The other great story that came out of that first week. So I graduated on Sunday. I anchored the news on Wednesday. Friday night, at the end of the 10 o'clock news, someone says, man, you've had a heck of a week. How about a cold beer? And I'm thinking, now you're talking, right? Let's go. So we went out to the Platte Bar, which is a railroader bar. North Platte, I don't know if it's still true today, but back then North Platte had the largest rail yard in the world. It was a 58-mile-long rail yard because North Platte is smack dab in the middle of the country.
Okay.
So all the UP and SP trains came in and they switched and then they went out. Huge rail yard. And there was this bar called the Platte Bar. And the Platte Bar had music. It had sawdust on the floor and not there for effect. It was just like a beer, blood, whatever hit it, right? So I walk into the Platte Bar with a blue suit and makeup on. Okay.
Oh, gosh. I can relate to this a little bit because I grew up in Roseville. Roseville's a railroad town. Yeah. And when I was a kid, I would go to, or a young adult, go to a bar. And you and I are about, I think you're a couple years younger than me, but yeah, the railroad workers are a certain type of individual. They're a rugged, individual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they are. And they're a great group of people. It's a culture that we don't know a lot about. Matter of fact, that'd be a great, kind of like Deadliest Catch. That'd be a great reality series, a railroader series,
yes. You
know? But anyway, so I walked in and I'm in a blue suit and I see this guy at the bar and he waves me over. And I noticed walking up, he was wearing jeans and boots like everyone else, but he had a sports coat on. So he's a little bit better dressed than most of the crowd in there. And he said, hey, I watched you tonight. And I asked the bartender, he told me you're brand new. He said, you know, I hope you like us. I know we're going to like you. Could I buy you a beer? I said, man, absolutely. So I sat down with him. I was sitting with him for 5 minutes before I realized it was the governor of the state of Nebraska. An incredible entrepreneur, wow. By the way, a guy named Bob Carey. Bob Carey was a Vietnam War hero. He lost a portion of his leg in Vietnam. He had started multiple restaurants in Omaha, and he became governor. And at the time, he was kind of famous around the country because he was moving his girlfriend into the state house, and her name was Deborah Winger. Remember, she was in Officer and a Gentleman.
I remember
right?
her well. I always liked her.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I mean, I thought, man, that is unbelievable local retail politics where you see the new anchor in town. You say, come over here. I want to buy you a
That's
beer.
That's great.
And I said to him, why are you, what are you doing here? You know, and he said, oh, if you come to North Platte, this is where you're going to come if you want to talk to people. Yeah. So, but that was my
That's
start in
cool.
Nebraska.
Okay, so you started off in the front of the camera, and some things never changed. You're with KCRA. Maybe walk me through, you know, the TV and the radio, now podcast, in addition to radio. Walk me through that journey a little bit, because that led somehow to you owning a business in wealth management.
Yeah, so I go off to grad school then, and I come back, and I truly thought I want to run a TV station. That's what I thought I wanted to do. So I went to work at Channel 3, and I ended up, it was actually another, they started overnight news, and they said, Kelly, we need you to do it for a few months till we find someone who will do it, because it was from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. during the week, and even later than that on the weekends. But the great part about it was, I was doing it every night with no one watching. So I got better much faster because I was doing it, right?
Yeah.
So I ended up doing that. I ended up anchoring the evening news on Channel 3, and it was a great gig. The station was owned by the Kelly family, and what made it really great for me was I was anchoring the news every night, but when something crazy happened, more often than not, I'd get the phone call. Hey, Kelly, Diana was just in a car accident. I need you in London tomorrow. Or, Kelly, the Kings are going to Tokyo to open the season. I need you to go and cover that. Or, I mean, I went to South America. I went to Europe for 3 weeks. I went to the Clinton-Yeltsin summit in Vancouver. I went to fires in Malibu. You know, just two or three times a year, they'd send you out on these things that just kept it all really interesting and fun. Kelly family sells. That's a great entrepreneurial story. They started that.
John Kelly, was it?
John Kelly and Bob Kelly. Remember, they hired me because I said, my name's on your letterhead. Their letterhead was Kelly Brothers Broadcasting.
Yeah, that's right.
And he said, damn, we do have to hire you. So he, but they sold. They, I think their dad started the business for $10,000 in the 50s, and they sold it in 99 or 2000 for $960 million or something like
that.
So they were great operators at the perfect time. They got out at the perfect time before the fragmentation of advertising dollars that we've seen. But after they sold, none of that, all that travel went away.
Okay.
Hearst, a great owner. They still own the station today, but they had a group in DC that did all that. And it became a little bit stale. And I thought, what am I going to do? And, so anyway, at the age of 40, I made a career transition, and a lot of people thought I was bananas. I was anchoring the 6 o'clock news on the number one station in what was the fastest growing market in the country. And I thought, I want to do something different. And they're like, what? This is easy money. Yeah. This is, and I, it was, I mean, it was,
as aren't most people's career path at that point, okay, I'm on a local station. Maybe I want to go to national news or something
right.
like that. That was, you wanted to keep it here. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that part of it?
Yeah, I didn't want to do the, okay, I'm going to go to Cleveland and then Houston, then maybe get a shot at the network. The one job I got offered, or at least they showed tremendous interest in giving me, and it was the one job I really thought about, was CNBC, the business NBC station, right? They wanted me to consider becoming the bureau chief in Silicon Valley. And they made a great pitch because they said, the world isn't changing in Paris or Moscow anymore. The world is changing in San Jose, and no one else is covering it. And they were right. They were dead on that all this stuff was happening there, and no one was there really to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at that time, for what they were offering, we would have had to live in a condo, you know, an hour away, or, you know, and then if, as my wife said, if you do really well, we get to move to New Jersey. Is that correct? Because that's where CNBC is based, Inglewood Cliffs. So, but anyway, yeah, and part of it, we just wanted to stay. We had, We were filling up a house with kids. We had nieces and nephews around the corner. It wasn't quite Haneyville, but it was as close as we were going to get. We had, you know, we have our kids are 4 out of 13 cousins who are as thick as thieves.
Nice.
And so it was going to take something really good to get me out. But I decided I want to make a change anyway. And my wife was very supportive. Like, yeah, this is not where you should be 20 years from now. So I really enjoyed the financial world. I enjoyed the investment world. I also thought there's this incredible hole of education in financial matters. Financial literacy is very low, you know, and my view of it is this, and I tell people this at our seminar. So 50 years ago, if you retired from a company, you were 65 years old, you retired, you got a gold watch, you had Social Security was fully funded, Medicare was fully funded, you probably had a pension, whether it was public sector or private sector, and you took 3 cruises and you died at 72. That was 50 years ago. Now you got people retiring and we have to plan. I mean, if a husband and wife walk in and they're relatively healthy at 65 years old, there's a 50-50 chance one of them hits 90.
Yeah.
Right? So we got to do a 30-year plan. And we got to do a 30-year plan with Social Security on the ropes, Medicare on the ropes financially. Now, granted, I think for the people in retirement, that's not going to change. I don't throw any sort of fear at them like that's going to go away. But pensions have gone away in the private sector. Mm-hmm. Pensions, I think, are likely to change in the public sector. Not go away, but just change to more of a hybrid approach. But it's a whole different game. In other words, your government and corporate America have offloaded the task of retirement planning to the individual at the very time we're all living longer. And it's a tough thing, and people are not prepared to deal with it. For me and my firm, it's the Permanent Employment Act. I mean, it means they need our help.
Right.
But mistakes are made in this world because people don't have the base financial literacy to understand how markets work over time. And so I want to do that, and I had a bunch of kids at home, and I had a very good friend by the name of Pete Scheid at Smith Barney who said, come on, man, I'll take you under my wing. Come on in. I'll teach you the business. And he did. And at the same time, to keep the mortgage current, keep food on the table, I took the job doing the 4-hour morning show on KFBK. So my day was I'd get up at 3:45 and I would do that show from 5 to 9 a.m. And at 9:15, I was at my Smith Barney office just, you know, getting my licenses, starting a practice, getting going. And at 40, that was an interesting transition to make. And I was very lucky to be able to do it.
Well, I have to imagine building your personal brand or having built a very strong personal brand in our region and then going into that line of work, it was very complimentary.
It was, but I also, you and I hang with some of the same people. And I had a few of them look at me and say, hey, Kelly, I like you. I respect you. I also know you weren't managing money 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to urge you to go practice with someone else's money and come see me in 5 years. And a few of them did that. And I did it. And 5 years later, I gave them a call. All right. I got $100 million under management. Here's what we're doing. Here are my results. Boom.
Okay, yeah.
And most of them became clients. And you know, I'm very happy that they did that. So no, there's no doubt the TV thing, you know, it more than like just having a brand awareness or people knowing you, it was that in doing that TV thing, I got to meet some really good business people, really, you know, people who, if they didn't become clients, I could at least say, hey, give me some advice. How do you handle this? Or, you know,
yeah, that's an interesting thing. I started my podcast kind of to help the community. It's obviously I don't get paid anything to do this, but I wanted to help by sharing stories like this. And I've been wanting to have you on my show for years. Finally, we got it to happen. But I feel like when we hear the story of a regular guy or woman that, you know, had some success, that people want to be able to identify with that. But along the way, as I've done these type of interviews, I've met some really, really good people that even though I didn't know what I would be doing today, they became part of my network, my friend group, if you will. And those relationships have been, I think, invaluable in this, I guess, next chapter of my career as well. So whether it's not, I don't know that it's a personal brand as much as it is, I've met some good people and have got some friends that I would have not had.
No, so. And I think it's an ecosystem we built for ourselves, and we hang around the people we admire, the people we'd like to be more like in many respects.
Who is that? Okay, so maybe give me a couple of names. Who are some of those people that you look up to or have looked up to throughout your journey? I know you mentioned the Kelly brothers, but are there people now that maybe our audience might even relate to?
Oh, my God. Some of the people.
I know you emceed a Lokesh Sicari, a Moneta Ventures thing. When I first invested into Moneta, I went to the event and you were emceeing. I'm like, okay, that's the guy that's made it, right, in the media world, but yet he's also respected in the financial world. Interesting combo.
And part of it too, Mark, is I feel like, especially in Sacramento, which can be a government town mentality, we don't give enough credit to people who go out on a limb, take a risk, real entrepreneurs who try to build a product or service that people then decide they want. I mean, that's, I don't know, to me, that's like the ultimate piece of Americana, the fact that you would actually try to do something that's brand new. And I hate to say, and you know, the worst part of my job right now, and I think I told you this on my podcast as well, but is to see the number of incredibly productive, high quality people who are leaving the state, whether it's for the politics, whether it's for tax reasons, whether it's for regulation, they want to manufacture something. It's just sad to see people leave the state, which maybe drew them or their families here in the first place because our attitude was so, yes, entrepreneur, yeah. go get it, you know? And now it feels like, no, you make money. We need more from you, you know? And I don't, there's got to be a happy middle here. But there's, I can't even begin to tell you the incredible, I mean, you know, Dale Carlson, what he's done for entrepreneurship, the way he, you know, just the way he leads his life. It's with love. It is. It's with love and concern. And again, Katie is the exact same way. The exact same way. And our family has been privileged to go on a mission trip down where we did nothing for a week but work on an orphanage 9,000 feet up in the Ecuadorian mountains with them. And it was one of the highlights of our lives. And he invited us on that. So, you know, a Dave Lucchetti, the way he, oh my God, the way he has built a business and has somehow kept his kids, grandkids grounded in a real sense of meaning and where real life lives, not in some of the trappings of success, you know? You know, the other guy, and I'll mention it to you because I know you're such a huge supporter of the veterans, but one of the greatest, probably the greatest thing I've ever been associated with in the broadcasting world were the Freedom Flights, where we took World War II vets back. And that was because I did an interview with a man. This was on the week they opened up the World War II Memorial in Washington. And I did an interview with a gentleman by the name of Keith Seward, who was not only an infantryman, but he was an illustrator. He drew out battle scenes and famous scenes from the war for the Army. And because they were opening up the World War II monument, they were putting his artwork on the walls of the Smithsonian.
Oh, wow.
And so I said to Keith, I said, you know, at the end of that interview, I said, hey, Keith, you know, your artwork's going to be on the walls of Smithsonian. Are you going to be able to get back and see that and see this monument, which is dedicated to you and everyone who served alongside you? And he said, Kelly, I'm 82 and I don't feel good every day. And I don't think I'm going to make it back. And it's like, oh, what a terrible end to an interview, you know? However, 30 seconds after I got off the air, the phone rang, and it was Alex Spanos, who is now departed, but was a huge, I mean, he's a Greek immigrant who had incredible respect for everyone who saved the world in World War II. And he said, Kelly, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard. And I have a private jet, and you and your wife are taking Keith and his wife back to see it. and I want I have a limo and I have your hotel and I've got your restaurants and I want you to treat him to the weekend of his life because his country owes him that. And that led to me coming back from that trip, which was a great success, and saying, and me sitting down with Alex, I brought him a small gift from the Sowards, and he said, you know, Kelly, it made me realize every World War II vet is in the exact same place. All of them are upper 70s, 80s. This was back in 04, 05, I think. Mm-hmm. And he said, so I think you need to go on KFBK and you need to raise money to bring more of them back. And here's, he said, I've looked it up and he handed me a check for $167,000. And he said, this is the price of chartering a 757 from Sacramento to DC and back. Here's your first flight. And he said, you need to raise money. People need to give this because they want to, but I want you to know that, if you need any additional money for anything, I will cover any shortfall. So he was an amazing general.
So a patriot.
Yeah. So we ended up doing five flights back with World War II vets. They brought a guest. We had a doctor and a nurse on each flight. We had a swing band at the final dinner. And it was a huge success because Alex Spano said, this should happen. Rush Limbaugh called in and gave $50,000. Wow. Because he said, first of all, I thought it was a great idea. And then I heard Alex Spanos was involved. I want to be involved too. So in the end, we raised, I forget how many hundreds of thousands, but it was five full flights went back. And that all, you know, that's the power of people's stories. And so I don't never lose sight of that. But that was, Alex Spanos was a guy who I admired as well.
So now you juggle this wealth management business. This is from an outsider's perspective. You've got you're on the radio. On my way to yoga, I listen typically to, in my way back, I'll typically listen to either KFBK or Sports 1140. And on Thursdays, I hear you on Sports 1140, typically talking with Carmichael Dave about the business of sports. So that's always intriguing to me. But then I hear your other short segments with, you know, on KFBK all day long. So, but then now you're a principal at, or you were a principal at Cap Trust, and now it's Cap Trust. Before it was
Genevieve's Burford and Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. So that's obviously a big role. So to me, it seems like a little bit of a juggle. I don't know if that's the way you look at it.
You're the king of all jugglers, Mark. You got 17 businesses going.
I look at it as all one thing, though, in my world.
Well, you know, mine has morphed from having to have multiple streams of income to, you know, a situation now where two of my kids are out of college, two are in college. But, you know, to me, it's all about Cap Trust and the work we do there, the wealth planning for individuals. We do a lot of work for endowments and foundations. We do retirement plans as well for a lot of major companies in the area. The TV and radio is just branding and getting the word out there. Mm-hmm. It really is. You know, the radio, it sounds like I'm on a lot, and but I just get up in the morning and I'm just doing my normal work, and then all of a sudden I'll see my body clock kind of goes off and I have 90 seconds.
Yeah, you can do that with one hand tied behind your back type thing
kind
at
of.
This stage.
Yeah, because I'm interested in following it anyway. And then in the afternoons, I call up anytime after 1 o'clock and I record three reports, boom, 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 and I'm done in 5 minutes, and they run them from 4 to 7.
Do you get your news from CNBC, or where do you find
everything? Yeah, okay. I mean, I love the Wall Street Journal, and the main reason I love the Wall Street Journal in this day and age of, and believe me, I am so concerned about our media because a free and independent press is just foundational to a democracy, and I feel like it's been corrupted. And it's been corrupted by profit. It's been corrupted because you know, both MSNBC and Fox News both want to serve a niche, right? Mm-hmm. It's been corrupted because newspapers are dead, and they were killed by, you know, all these other advertising venues, whether it's Google or Amazon or any of the rest of them. And so, and that model used to provide, you and I used to deliver them, but that was also, those were the only outlets. Radio and TV never did this. Those were the only outlets that covered school board meetings and city council meetings and county supervisor meetings and planning commission meetings. They had someone there. No one does that anymore. That would hold people to account, you know? So I'm really kind of concerned about, you know, where our media is going. But for me, you know, it really is just about branding. And also, I must admit, I hope that there are certain snippets we give out that just somehow, you know, move the lever just a little bit, move the needle a little bit in terms of increasing financial literacy. Mm-hmm. Just understanding, you know, I believe financial literacy, entrepreneurship should be taught in every school. We do a number of events at CapTrust. The one that we all enjoy the most and always gets the best reaction is it's for our clients' kids and grandkids. It's called Money 101. It's 4 hours. What's a stock? What's a bond? What's debt? When is it appropriate to use debt? How do you plan financially? What is entrepreneurship? You know, how do you create your own path in life? So it's stuff that isn't getting taught in all high schools, and it needs to be, because like I said, in a world where that task of retirement planning has been handed off to you and me, that's got to be taught at a foundational level.
It does. And there are a few, I'll call it school districts and municipalities in and around the region that are understanding that we need some of that. And so our group, the Growth Factory, ends up going in and working with high schools to drive entrepreneurial thinking, and people are actually building businesses and that kind of thing. It's amazing the brilliant young minds that exist, freshmen in high school building a successful company that might get funded. That kind of thing is happening in some of these programs. And it's gratifying when, you know, you turn on the news and all we do see, what feels like is negativity. Really, there are very motivated, ambitious, driven people and families and communities that we should rally around, right? Rally around those people that are trying to help themselves.
No, we absolutely should. And you're right. I'm not trying to paint. Some schools have some very good financial literacy. Some economics teachers go out of their way to teach personal financial management and not just graphs where supply hits demand. Mm-hmm. You know, and those are fantastic. I just wish it were mandatory, and it's not yet. It is mandatory in 36 states, but not in California yet.
Okay.
And the more guys like you and I can get out there and talk to schools, the better off everyone's going to be, because you're right. There are an incredible amount of good stories out there of kids who have real dreams, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So thinking about your client base, might be some of my friends or people that I know, and some people that I talk to I think the general public maybe has some concern about the economy right now. And while this show is not about financial advice in any way, what's concerning you in terms of the economy today? Because we got geopolitical risk. We have, you know, people talking about inflation. We got stuff that is like, it's in the news. It's in our face. Does anything concern you now or more than?
Oh my God. What doesn't concern me? But you know, we're in it for the long game. We're not day traders. And this year is a strange year. It's going to feel like an S show. It just is, because it's an election year and candidates just crap on each other day in, day out. And we all feel worse about where we are and who we have chosen to lead us. We do. It's a natural thing. So, assuming no big exogenous event, you know, some sort of a, you know, invasion by someone, China, if Russia doesn't go for, you know, assuming no big exogenous event. And if the Fed does, as they say they think they'll do, and that is cut rates by the end of the year, probably 1, 2, 3 times, it should be a decent year. It already has been a good year. If you look at the overall return, it's already been a decent year. So, but again, we do tend to take the longer term. My biggest, I told you about, you know, it's sad just to see people leaving. And I get it. For some folks, it's not just a money thing. It's a moral imperative. I had one guy in my office 6 months ago. He's selling his company next year, so he has to. He thinks he has to leave the state this year. And I pushed back. I said, you don't have to move. Your lifestyle wouldn't change. You'd still have your friends. You'd still be playing golf where you play golf. And he almost had tears in his eyes. He said, but I look at that number. And he circled the number that California would claim if he stayed in the state. Mm-hmm. And he said, I can't ignore the fact that that would pay for the college educations of all 9 of my grandkids. I can't ignore that. I mean, what kind of grandpa would I be? And it was really almost like a moral thing. Hmm. So there's that which bothers me. And I just wish in California we could learn to, by the way, I never finished what I said about the wall. Reason I love the Wall Street Journal as a source is because they have news, they have opinion, and they tell you what's news and what's opinion. And I like that. It's very clear. It's very black and white. The other thing that concerns me, and I think about it a lot, and that is the incredible proclivity of our government to spend money and what that means for the value of a dollar over time, what that means as we pile up these extraordinary amounts of debt. And it's not a political thing because Republicans have not been talking about it either. This is just Trump spent a lot of now Trump's last year, COVID, obviously. So there's a, but then Biden upped it even further. And, you know, as of, I mean, not to date this podcast, but as of February of 2024, our debt service payments are more than we spend on defense for the first time ever. And that's just debt service. That's not paying down an ounce of principal. That's just interest. And we knew that would kind of happen because as interest rates go up and they have to reissue, you know, 5 and 10 year government bonds, and that rate has gone up, we're paying more and more. So, you know, I don't know where that goes. I have a sneaking suspicion that that may be one reason why gold has hit an all-time high. That may be one reason why Bitcoin hit 69,000. I mean, because people are thinking, all right, what is going to hold value if our government's just going to print money like crazy right. and keep spending it? So yeah. That's what worries me.
What is the other choice? And that is, I guess, some kind of default. But chances are for the foreseeable future, for at least, you know, I think for the next few years, we're going to see more printing. We have to. How are we going to not print money? Because we don't have the stomach to cut services.
I know. And the sad, the really dangerous part about it, Mark, is this, I know it feels like there's a lot going on, but we're technically in peacetime. We're not in wartime. You could absolutely justify a lot of debt if it was World War II, but it's not. And we're still, what happens if we find ourselves in that position? Then what? Now you're Venezuela.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, I think about that a lot and about how to hedge the risk of that. Now, you can obviously, a lot of our international investments are done in the local currencies internationally, wherever they are. But it should be a concern to people because the sad part is it does not seem to be a concern to anyone in Washington.
No, it doesn't. I'm going to go back to your client's perspective on the moral obligation to leave on behalf of his grandchildren's college needs or potential needs. It's an interesting, it's not that I'm surprised to hear that because we all know people leave in California, they retire, a lot of them are retiring from the state, taking their state pension, our tax dollars, and moving somewhere where they don't have to pay taxes, right? We see that happening. It's like, oh man, you're taking PERS money and leaving town with it. But I come from a slightly different perspective in that I feel a moral obligation to be where my family is going to be and provide roots and leadership and do what I can do to help. If everybody sort of pitches in and helps build something, we're trying to build the backyard advantage, right? But the attitude is the moral obligation to build versus bail. And I feel like that's a it's almost an ethical thing for me that that's the right thing to do. It's the right way to live my life. It's the right way to show my grandchildren what's important, that we can't just run from the problem. Let's do our best to stick it out and help solve, you know, what's not perfect, because it hasn't been perfect in any city, in any country ever. So people, you can't just bail.
No, you can't. And that's a valid point. Absolutely, it is. I think, and I've told a number of clients, hey, you tell me where your grandkids are and I'll tell you if you're moving or not.
Yeah.
You know, and most are, they're not going to move. But however, I have had folks who've left and just said, listen, whether they go to Arizona, Texas, Tennessee, they said, I kind of hope that after college our kids come this way, because they make the point, I don't know when my kids would be able to afford a house in California. Mm-hmm. You know, the life we gave them may not be possible with current, you know, where it stands today. Good. So every family has to make their own best decision.
For sure.
Right. And I just wish that. And I actually, you know, with the recent election, I think there's some sanity coming back into as to how we handle crime and the fact that I just wish we had more of an ability as a society to look at decisions made and without blame, but with purely with the mindset of how do we do it better next time, you know, make those decisions, whether it's about COVID. Let's look back and did masks work? Did the vaccine mandates work? Did the shutting down of schools work? I mean, just to be able to ask those questions in a non-political bubble and say, just for if when it happens again, what do we do? Or, you know, in California, the homeless issue, you can't just keep throwing good money after bad. At some point, you say, no, maybe we need to approach this a different way, or how do we do that? And I don't, sadly, everyone's a little too concerned about their record on the issue, whereas I wouldn't be. I'd be like, no, that didn't work, and that's a sunk cost. That's so 2019 to think about, you know?
Well, hallelujah to that perspective, and I think that it's almost like common sense. So as far as I'm concerned, and hopefully that will resonate with people. If enough of us start being in that, you know, common sense type mindset versus let's just go fight first and then we'll sort it out.
Yeah.
I don't know what else I need to cover, but I do think that it's important to. Oh, I know what I was going to cover with you on some of the leaving California piece. Sacramento is growing a little bit while the rest of the state is shrinking in population a little bit. And so there's a reason why people are moving here to the place that you and I live. And what's your how would you prognosticate the Sacramento economy, and you know, why is it working here better than maybe it's working in other areas?
I think Sacramento is the value-priced major city in California. I think that, you know, relative to L.A., San Diego, San Jose, San Francisco, ooh, you can get a lot more house here. And that's a good thing. And there are jobs here. And, you know, it's... and I think it's not, you know, that thinking is not all that different than Barry Broom kind of, you know, talks about Sacramento being kind of the value priced corner of Silicon Valley. And Barry Broom, by the way, I think has done an incredible job of figuring out who we are long before many of us figured out who we were. He just speaks of the region with a way that in a way and defines us in a way that I had not heard before, but 99% of it is spot on. And when he goes out and tries to get companies to move here, he talks about Silicon Valley. And it's legitimate. If you go to Tokyo, Japan, and you land at Narita, it is 2 hours to get from Narita into downtown Tokyo. You know, so to think that we could be a part of Silicon Valley redefined is absolutely mm-hmm. valid.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, what bothers me, because a lot of folks will poo-poo it and say, you know, I understand the tech titans leaving and Larry Ellison and, you know.
You talked about that this morning. They're buying up Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I heard that.
Yeah. Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison. you know, they're all buying up Hawaiian. That's a huge debate over there as to how much outsiders should be allowed to buy. Of course, Larry Ellison bought 98% of the island of Lanai. But, you know, and they have left. And that hurts. That absolutely hurts because, you know, our tax code is so dysfunctional. I wish we could just start with a grease board and start over again on our tax. But, I mean, you know, with the top 1% paying 50% of the tax in the state, it doesn't take many of them leaving before we feel it. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the fact that in the last 5 years, two of the four richest men in the world have left California and taken their businesses with them, that is a, if you do any sort of a 25 to 30 year projection on that, that's a $1 trillion move out of California in terms of tax dollars. But those aren't the ones I'm worried about. I mean, I am for the state because they bring so much revenue or have in the past. U-Haul will tell you that by far California's largest outbound. And U-Haul, tech titans are not using U-Haul. These are hardworking people who just make the decision, I'm better off somewhere else. And that has never happened in the history of the state. So it's we need to, I mean, I think this was inevitable. But I think we needed the pushback we're getting, but we got to change something about the way our taxes work and the way we spend money too, you know?
Agreed. Okay. So, I could talk to you all day long, but just for the sake of your time, I know you have, places to be.
Well, I'm good. We got another 5 hours.
Okay.
At least,
all right. Well, I want some, I know I don't want to go into the investment side of things, but you are a winner. You are a proven winner. It didn't necessarily come the way everybody else did, but you figured it out. Can you give us some like top reasons why you've been successful and maybe some words of wisdom in terms of like how other people might want to approach a life that has got your kind of success?
Well, get lucky and have great parents who really just want to instill discipline and ethic. You know, in addition to paper routes, my dad bought up some small apartment houses. But every weekend, my brother and I were painting or raking the leaves or doing something at those apartment houses. It was just an automatic. Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, we were heading over to do whatever we were going to do. So there was a good work ethic there. And that's so key because if a young person doesn't get that, I don't think they ever. It's hard to develop in your 30s. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is. It's hard to not. It takes a little while to understand that hard work ain't going to kill you. I would say always. First of all, and then luck again in finding a great spouse. You know that, right?
Yeah. How long have you been married?
30 years this year.
30 years. Yeah, we're going to come up on 39. Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I know.
She's a saint.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I hate to say that. That's dumb luck. And sometimes I think I put too much pressure on my kids because I tell them that.
Yeah.
I tell them it doesn't, you know, yeah, what you do, where you work, where you live, all important, but nothing comes close to who you choose to spend the rest of your life with.
Without question.
You know? But at the same time, I think it's like, they're like, whoa, no, just go date someone. So there's that. You know, I always, I have a few nephews now who are moving into that second tier of their careers. And I'm like, you know, and all I told them was, if you ever have the choice, you always take equity over income. Always.
Mm.
The idea being that if you're building ownership in something, you first of all, you can't spend that until you sell it, right?
Yeah.
Income, half of it's going to go to the government. Yeah. You're just going to spend the rest.
Yeah, you're not paying tax, well, necessarily on the equity.
For a while.
Yeah.
Until you want to. A lot of my friends, you know, hey, what can I do for a young person to get them going? One of the great tools to get someone going in understanding a little bit about the markets and understanding, you know, and having that long-term perspective is when they start working, open up a Roth IRA. And my deal with my kids was whatever you put into your Roth IRA, I will match. Now, you can only put into a Roth IRA each year your earned income. So, for example, I had a daughter one time who made a ton of money babysitting, nannying for a family. But she didn't have W-2 income, so we couldn't put it in. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be income in the eyes of the IRS, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, you put money into a Roth IRA when you're 18, 19, 20, that money will grow over time and come out to you tax-free. And 50 years from now, tax-free is going to mean something. Mm-hmm. When you think about the spending we've already talked about, right? You want that to build. That is the most valuable money you'll ever have. Not only that, you know, if kids are relatively driven and want to succeed in life, there's a very good chance that their income will phase them out of Roth IRA eligibility relatively early. So you want to get that done early. So it's one of those tools because they can't touch it till they're 59 and a half, mm-hmm. but they're investing, they're seeing the statement. They can help, you know, no, I want to own Tesla. I want to own whatever. But it's a great starter with real value down the road, and they really can't touch it anytime soon. Yeah. So that's a great little learning activity. And you know, you can go online at Schwab or Fidelity and open one up. You don't need me to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone could do that.
Yeah.
So those are just a few little
tidbits. Those are awesome. Thank you for what you, thanks for coming on the show for sure, but thank you for what you do in terms of bringing us the financial news. I've been a fan for a long time, but also, you know, helping shape Sacramento. People look up to you and you lead by example. You're not afraid or shy about sharing your viewpoint, but you share it in a way that is not threatening or divisive. You share it in a way like, let's win. Let's figure out how to win. And I love that about you.
Oh, thanks. I try. I really do. And I've tried to stay down the middle as much as I can as well. But it, if I get passionate about it sometimes, it's only because I want my kids and my grandkids someday to enjoy the California you and I have enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see that threatened in any way. But, you know, the world changes and you got to change with it, or you got to hop in and try to inspire change yourself. So great to be on with you, Mark. You're an inspiration to all of us because you've taken all these ideas and actually put them into a building and a program that works. And so kudos to you and your entire staff. You guys do great work.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming on the show.
All right, buddy.
All right. Thank you. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.